Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Simon Phipps joins me. We're going to look at Yasode, a web framework written in Haskell. You are not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps. Episode 236, recorded December 19th, 2012. Yasode. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz, MerlinAtStoneAnge.com, bringing you each week, or almost each week, as often as I can, the big projects, the little projects, the projects you probably use every day, the projects that you might not have heard of, like maybe this week's project. We'll see when we get into the show, but as always, I'm joined by a wonderful co-host. This week, no exception to that, Mr. Simon Phipps. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Randall. It's good to be back on the show again for this wrap-up for the year.
Very cool. Very cool. We have an interesting guest today. I know, another web framework. But, you know, I think this one's got some interesting things about it. For one, it's written in Haskell. Well, let me talk about the name of the guy first. It's Michael Snoyman. I hope I get that right. Michael Snoyman is going to be speaking to us about the, and I think I've been mispronouncing this based on the pronunciation guide I saw on the web this morning, the Yasode, I think it is, web framework. So this is a web framework, which means that you're going to write web applications in it. But it's written in Haskell. My experience with Haskell is when the Perl 6 project decided to try a trial implementation of Perl 6 written in Haskell, sort of as a demonstration proof of concept of some of the design principles of Perl 6. And it actually became sort of the reference compiler for Perl 6 for a while. So that was my experience of Haskell. But on the downside, every time I tried to learn Haskell, I couldn't get my head around it. So I'm hoping Michael can tell us why Haskell and what's great about this web framework. I'm pretty sure he'll be able to do that. Have you checked into this at all, Simon?
You know, it seemed like a two thoughts I had never thought of joining together, Haskell and web programming.
Yes.
Two thoughts that had never touched for me. So I'm going to be very interested to see what he's got to say about that.
Well, good. Well, that'll be great. So we'll bring him on in just a moment. Before that, let's see if I've got any other business I have to do. Where are my list? Oh, there we go. I have no other business to do. So, well, having said all that, let's go ahead and bring on the guest. Michael, see if I get this right. Michael Snoyman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And I always get this backwards. Get it right. Where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking to you from Israel, northern Israel to be precise, the barren wastelands up here.
Wow. No bombings happening outside or anything? You're okay, right?
That's in the south.
This week
it's in the south.
Okay, good. We're safe. Actually, I was in Israel a couple months ago, and what I was really amazed by was just how small the country is. I for some reason, I was thinking that all these countries in the Middle East are large, but apparently the fighter jets, as they're flying overhead to patrol the areas, have to make sure to make their turns quick enough or they actually end up invading other people's airspaces.
It actually takes me less time to drive through the entire country here than it would take me back in California to drive half the state. So it's a pretty small country.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I did a kind of a halfway job at trying to describe what's interesting and unique about, I'm going to get this wrong, Yasode, something like that.
Yeah, good, Yasode. Yeah.
Okay. So I gave it sort of the high level view. I've done a lot of web development in my life, so I've been researching this for a couple of weeks, trying to figure out how we're going to be talking about this. But let's hear it right from your mouth. What's the Yasode web framework, and what problem does it solve?
So Yasode web framework, I would say the biggest feature of it is actually the host language. The host language is Haskell. Yasode itself tries as much as possible to avoid doing anything that's really, new, innovative. It tries to stick to tried and true approaches as much as possible. So fits in the same category as, say, Rails, an MVC framework, lots of the same kinds of approaches that you're used to seeing over there. The distinction that we try to make is we try to take advantage of everything that Haskell gives us. So Haskell is very big on type safety, on immutability, on concurrency. So we try to go ahead and pull those features into the web framework as much as possible, make them first-class citizens, and therefore make it a much more pleasant experience to create safe, concurrent web applications.
So I wouldn't necessarily use this, say, as a content management system per se. I would use this more if I'm writing interactive web apps that have a lot of interaction with the user, right?
Correct. You might want to use Yasode to build the CMS, but Yasode itself wouldn't be a CMS on its own.
Okay, so what's does this run? Okay, so Haskell is a fully compiled language. It compiles down to machine code, from what I think I'm aware of that. I would know whether I'm aware of that or not. That's not the question. what do I remember about Haskell is the question now. it's early in the morning here. Okay, so how does this run under a framework like Apache or something? I mean, how do I get this to be operating on a machine?
So, like you said, Haskell does compile down to machine code. It is a fully compiled language. What we have is actually a very similar concept to what a lot of other languages have. In Ruby, you have Rack. In Java, you have the concept of servlets. In the Haskell world, we have this concept called the web application interface, which is this generic interface that sits between your applications over here and your web server, whatever that happens to be. So you could go ahead and use Yasode on top of CGI or FastCGI or any of those other kinds of standard approaches for hosting a web application. But the recommended approach is actually to use our built-in web server, which is called Warp. So it's a web server written in Haskell, optimized for the kinds of use cases that we're throwing at it. And it's a pretty seamless deployment. So you basically end up with a single executable at the end of the day. This executable has a web server and your application all bundled together, and then you just run it.
So the Haskell program's actually itself is listening on port 80 and then providing responses back. Is the equivalent of green threads then to manage the concurrency, or how does that work out?
That's actually a great question. One of the big features of Haskell is its multi-threaded runtime. So when you go ahead and you fork a thread in Haskell, unless you do something special, typically we go ahead and we create green threads with our runtime system. Those green threads are all handled by an evented backend. So something like KQ or libev, something like that is sitting behind. It depends on which operating system you're on. So when you go ahead and you fork a thread and then you start listening on a socket, it's actually a non-blocking operation. So we're fully asynchronous, but as far as the programming model that you're dealing with, you can pretend as if you're in a synchronous programming model. So as far as we're concerned, it's a little bit of the best of both worlds. You get the performance of asynchronous operations, but the ease of programming of a threaded approach.
Does that mean you also have the equivalent of session variables and things? I mean, can I have like a continuous session go along as the multiple hits come in from a given browser?
Yeah, we definitely have all the... So Yasode tries to stick to RESTful principles. So as much as possible, we encourage people to avoid using state. But obviously, there are times, such as session variables, where you absolutely have to have some kind of state. So there are multiple ways you can do it. One approach, we have something called client session. This is actually an approach that we gleaned from the Rails world. You go ahead and you put all of the session information into a cookie, and you store it, and that gets stored on the client side and sent with each request. And the advantage of this approach is it makes it much easier to do horizontal scaling. You don't have to try to save any kind of session information between multiple web servers. Each web server will have immediate access to it. It can also, even in a single server approach, some claims say that this is actually a more efficient approach simply because it's avoiding the need for a database lookup. But beyond all that, so we do have client session as the primary session backend. You could implement your own kind of session backend with a database, with Memcache, any other kind of approach that you want to take.
So how did Yasode come into being, and why was it started? I mean, there are plenty of web frameworks out there.
Right. So when I started Yasode, it was about 4 or 5 years ago. There wasn't actually a lot of activity at the time, or at least not a lot of public activity, of things moving forward in the Haskell web realm. Since then, things have changed a lot. There are actually three very active web frameworks in the Haskell world. But at the time, there wasn't really anything that was targeting the same kind of high-level rapid application development that we were seeing in other programming languages. So my options when developing a new application were, okay, either I could go for a dynamic language, which I'd used in the past. I'd actually used Django for a while. So I could go for that kind of approach, or I could stick to the language that I really liked and develop it from scratch. And I took the second approach.
Okay. And as you were starting this, was there a lot of interest from other people too, or were you just mostly just hammering on it until it became mature enough that people could then be interested in it?
The community process is very interesting. There were people expressing interest right from the beginning. There was also, but I would say that for a while, I was really the sole developer. This was, I'd worked on open source projects before, but this was definitely the first time that I was running a project by myself. And it was definitely the first time that I was actually, the scale that I was working on was much larger than I'd worked on before. So to start off with, I was really running the project on my own. About a year into the project, after the code base started to stabilize a bit, we started getting more developers on team. And that was definitely for me, that was a huge learning experience in how to work with a large distributed open source community.
Right. So I'm interested. I'm just looking at your Olo stats here at the moment. And it's quite interesting. It looks to me like you've probably got, there's about five core people working with you, probably about another 10 to 15 who contribute occasionally, and an overall cloud of about 50. Would you say that's about right?
Yeah, those numbers sound about right.
Right, right. And so, and you're under the MIT license, I see. So there's it's completely open for anyone to do whatever they want with the code.
Correct. Yeah, we've gone definitely for a permissive license. We used to be under the BSD3. Some people put in a request that we switch over to the MIT license. That happened about a year ago. But yeah, I think the entire application stack at this point is either MIT or BSD3.
Right. And I see that you're hosted on GitHub, so I assume you're using a GitHub-style governance with people making pull requests and you taking them on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah, there are a few other contributors. I think there are, people with commit access. I think there are about six or seven people with commit access to our main repositories. We've actually broken things up into multiple repositories because we... one of the approaches that we try to take in the Haskell world is breaking down our software into much smaller packages that can be reused. So we actually end up having four different repositories. And I think there's, between all those repositories, there are probably seven or eight people who have commit access. But even people within myself, sometimes if I work on something which is a little bit more experimental, we'll go ahead and we'll use the pull request approach, have other people review it before it actually gets merged in.
Right, right. And I see that it looks to me from the Olo graph like your contributions are gradually tailing off over the year. Is that a reflection of the development cycle, or is that is that real, or is that just an accident of Olo's stats?
No, actually, that's pretty accurate. What you're seeing is that as time has gone on, the core of Yasod is actually starting to stabilize quite a bit. So we're not really adding so many brand new features to the core of Yasod. Where work is actually starting to go on now is more on the client side. We have what we consider to be a pretty stable, pretty well-developed server-side framework. We're missing some things on the client-side integration. So there are a few new projects that have popped up, such as Yasod Fay, which is integrating with a Haskell to JavaScript compiler called Fay. And we're starting to develop on that. I'm actually using that for a few projects myself. I know there are a few other people in the community who are checking out Fay at this time. So I would say it's what you're really seeing is we're starting to have a shift in focus.
Right, right. And just looking down your community here, what would you say was their general profile? Are they consultants who are using the technology, or do you have some corporate contributors involved in there? What's the sort of membership profile of that community?
So we've definitely done surveys. The last survey we did, I think the majority of people actually came from either the hobbyist or the academic background, with a very solid, probably 20 or 30% of people who are using this in some kind of commercial setting. So I definitely know there are some consultants who have been pushing Yasod for the projects that they do. They've, for whatever reasons, they've decided that was the better approach to push to their clients. And then the company that I'm working at now, we're building software off of Yasod. There are definitely a few others that are creating business models around using Yasod as the core platform.
Right, right. So what would you say was the future of your development cycle here? You say it's the code stabilizing. Do you think there's going to be a point where you'll effectively suspend development of that core and then branch and work on a next major version number? Or do you think you're going to carry on developing on this branch? Or what do you think the future looks like?
So that's always been a very difficult question. As we, you know, we had a big milestone set for ourselves to hit the 1.0 release, which we did earlier this year. And up until then, we definitely had a very rapid cycle of changes. From version 0.8 to 0.9, there could have been a huge number of changes that would have broken people's code bases. And that's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, we're greatly improving the code base. On the other hand, no one can actually really depend on this as a solution to go forward. So our goal was, starting with the 1.0 series, really try to solidify things. We're trying as much as possible to avoid breaking changes. So if we run into situations where we see there's a major problem that the API needs to be radically changed in order to solve something, we'll do it. We're just reluctant to do so unless there's a true need. We'd prefer to add extra functions, deprecate old ones, and do a more of a rolling cycle so that our existing users are able to continue using Yasode without any kind of interruption.
Right.
So in that community, would you say that there are very many business users of Haskell, or is its reputation as an academic language really borne out by your community?
I would say for the most part, yes, the majority of the community is academic, but it's not as overwhelming as one might think. I don't have precise numbers. It's hard to take a guess, but there are a number of companies that are either using Haskell to some small extent, and there are actually a large number of companies that are building their entire business model around Haskell. Not necessarily Yasode, but Haskell, for example, in the financial industry, bears itself out very well. When you want to have code that compiles down to something fast and that you can vet the code and ensure that it's actually doing the right thing, Haskell's a great choice. So in the financial industry, it's definitely taken off.
Okay, so I'm gonna pick up on that because my exposure to Haskell was starting about 6 years ago, I think it was, when one of the first test implementations of Perl 6 was in Haskell. And I've got to say, I'm no dummy, but every time I read to about the third or fourth chapter of the Haskell tutorial and it started talking about monads, I got really, really lost. So is there a way to get into Haskell that even us old timers can figure out, or is this strictly a language for academics that have actually taken 4 years of CS?
There was a great blog post that came out, I think it was 2 years ago, called Monads Are Like Burritos. And it was specifically targeted at this concept that a lot of Haskell developers, you know, or new developers to Haskell, start learning the language, run into this concept of monads, and everyone's talking about how complicated monads are, so they must be really complicated. And by the time they get to the end of this learning cycle, they write up a tutorial, which only makes sense to this person who just wrote it. And it just feeds into the continuing cycle of making it look like a complicated concept. Mm-hmm. I think that with some of the more modern approaches that we've been seeing coming out in the past few years, real world Haskell, Learn UI Haskell, we've definitely changed the tactics from the community for how people should be getting into the language. When I started with Haskell, none of these tools were available. I actually probably dropped, you know, when I first learned Haskell, I played around with it for a bit, got stuck on monads or something of the sort, and dropped the language for a few months until I came back and decided to attack it again. I don't believe that people who are trying to learn Haskell today are going to run into the same kinds of hurdles. If they are, they can definitely report it to the community. The community is a very responsive community, and you know, there's a very active IRC channel and a very active mailing list where people are happy to give any kind of feedback, any kind of help that they're able to at any time.
Well, that starts to sound convincing, but you're going to tell me that the three sets of scars that I have on my head up here from beating my head against the wall the other three times I tried to learn this, that I should just forget about that and just give up and try to do it again, right? I should just pick up the new materials and try to learn Haskell again.
I'll put it this way. I think that Haskell is not necessarily a more complicated language than many other languages out there. I do believe it is a very different language. If you're looking at comparing Ruby and Python, you can almost say that they're really just different syntaxes for the same thing. When you're talking about Java, C++, okay, yeah, you can talk about single inheritance, multiple inheritance, but it's still an object-oriented language. Even within that realm, you have the static versus dynamic languages, but it's not a huge distinction. When you come into the world of Haskell, the idea of making purity a first-class citizen, the idea of isolating side effects and immutability by default, these are all concepts that are very foreign to people coming from many other languages. Some people claim, I'm not going to necessarily make the claim, some people would claim, though, that Haskell is just as easy to learn as any other language if you don't come into it with the baggage you've come in with an imperative language. I can't say that for certain. I came in as an imperative programmer, so I don't really have the experience to say that. But it's a claim.
Well, that's why I thought it was so interesting because, you know, I've programmed in almost every style of language out there. I blew my mind finally learning Prolog, and I wrote immutable programs in Logo many years ago. So I actually wrote a magazine article about how to write stuff in Logo that only does applicability and creates new variables rather than using fset on any existing variable. So I understand a lot of the concepts. Just it seems like the descriptions, again, this is 6 years ago now, but yeah, it seems like the descriptions were written for someone with a stronger CS background than I had. So I'm happy to hear that there's no more bridging material out there. So that may inspire me to go do this. Now, having said all that, how much Haskell do I need to know to be able to use this framework? Because I said it somewhere. It says, you don't need to know much Haskell. And I'm going, no, all the examples, they're full of Haskell. So I don't know what you're saying there.
So it depends on what you're going to be doing. We have, you know, similar to the other frameworks that are out there, we have a scaffolding. You can go ahead and use a few simple tools to get up and running quickly. And then for most, you know, creating your HTML, your CSS, and JavaScript, we have special languages. We have what we call the Shakespearean languages. These are templating languages. You don't have to touch any Haskell at all to create those files. We have as you start getting into more complicated stuff, you will have to learn more and more Haskell. But you can definitely deal with a subset of Haskell. You know, some might call it the imperative subset of Haskell. You can treat Haskell like a normal imperative language, and you can get pretty far with Yesod using it in that way.
Okay, and we've had a couple questions from the chat room. I want to make sure that we cover those. I'm presuming that Haskell has a lot of standard database connections, like I could talk to Postgres or MySQL or something?
Yeah, so Yesod actually has a persistence backend, and that backend has backends for PostgreSQL, MySQL, MongoDB, SQLite, and we've been experimenting with the CouchDB backend. Outside of the world of Yesod, there are a number of other database backends. One of the other web frameworks in Haskell called HapStack actually has an in-memory database called Acid State, which actually has very good performance characteristics. So you definitely have your options. We have there are specific people in the Yesod community, commercial users I know of, who are using Microsoft SQL Server and Oracle. We don't actually have integration with Persistent directly, so they're doing that at a more low level. But you can actually access all of those through standard Haskell libraries.
Okay, and also another question from the chat. I want to make sure we're covering all these for the people that are watching along with the show. Someone wanted to know, I forgot who it was. Sorry, I didn't write down the name. Can you run multiple apps in a given server? I mean, can I just have different paths that correspond to different sort of mechanisms?
Oh, that's a good question. So yeah, what we discussed earlier was using the built-in web server and listening on port 80. In addition to that, you can use there are a few techniques. You could use something called reverse proxying. So you would have what's called the front-end server, could be Nginx. We actually have our own deployment server, but that's a separate issue. So you could use something like Nginx sitting as the front-end server, and it would pass off requests to different Yesod instances in the back-end. So the Yesodweb.com is sitting on a shared EC2 instance, which is sitting with, I think, four or five other Yesod applications. So we're serving all of those from exactly the same box. It's all done through reverse proxying. So it's definitely possible in the real world to do something like that.
Okay. And so what, in terms of a web framework, first let me cover the templating thing. So there's a templating language where there's some sort of embedded markup and maybe some of that is just inserting a variable, but you might have more complex things like flow of control sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, we have looping. So we have for all, we have conditionals, we have a few other special cases. We actually have something called pattern matching. People who are familiar with Haskell would probably know about this already. In Haskell, one of the things that we have is algebraic data types or sum types, which if you go back to the C world, that would be what you'd call a union, which turns out to be a very useful feature in a lot of code. So you can actually go ahead and create a data type which could be in multiple different states depending on which constructor it's using. And inside your template, you could switch and run different and generate different kinds of HTML depending on which state that variable was in. Simplest example would be if the user is logged in, do X. If the user is not logged in, do Y.
Yeah, actually, I was going to bring that up. I thought it'd be obvious that that would be a good solution there. So, I don't think I've asked this yet. Where did the name come from?
Yesod is actually a Hebrew word. I live in Israel, so it's a Hebrew word. Yes. It means foundation. So it was the foundation for what I was, the projects I was working on at the time seemed to fit, and it wasn't claimed by anyone else, so it seemed like a good choice.
Sounds nicely distinct. And as I'm interacting with this as a programmer then, I'm writing templates and using those, but is this more of a, the framework provides classes and I'm creating my own classes calling those, or am I overriding parts of the behavior of the built-in classes, adding my own hooks specifically at the right times? Or how would you describe the interaction with the framework?
There's a little bit of both.
Okay.
We have something that it's not exactly the same thing as a class. It's closer to, say, an interface in Java. We have something in Haskell called type classes. And there is a Yesod type class, which you have to implement when you create your own Yesod application. And that contains, say, 20 or so methods. And you can use the default values if you want, or you could override them. So you could go ahead and put in special functionality to override the 404 handler page or other things along those lines. So in that sense, you're overriding existing code. On the flip side, let's say that you want to add in a new handler. You want to now add in a page which is going to have an RSS feed. So what you would do is you would go to the routing list. Actually, we have a tool that would allow that does all this for you automatically. But what it's doing out of the surface is you would go to this file that has the route list. You would add in the route that you want to handle. You would give it a name. And then you would write a function. So let's say that you called this RSS feed. Then you would write a function called get RSS feed and write all your code in there. If you don't write that function, then the compiler won't compile and say, sorry, you need to provide this function in order for us to create your application.
Okay. So, and actually, I'm getting a whispering in my ear here. Given the relatively, I'm probably going to offend some people here. Let me see if I can say this without being too offensive. Given the relatively small community of Haskell developers, though, if I were a business choosing a web framework, why would I pick Haskell over other languages then?
So if you're approaching developers as, okay, we can hire a thousand Java developers to do all of our work for us, probably then you don't want to go for Haskell. If you're approaching this from the standpoint of we want to use the right tool for the job, we're happy to hire people who are able to spend a week, 2 weeks, and come up to speed on a new tool, or hire people who are already experts in this. There are, even though Haskell has a relatively small size, there are actually a fairly large number of well-trained Haskellers out there. So if you're trying to produce quality code, I would argue Yesod is one of the best tools for that. A lot of the things which would only be caught through extensive unit tests in other languages are caught automatically by the compiler. One of the examples we have of this is we have built-in cross-site scripting attack protection. It is unless you start using unsafe functions, you really aren't exposed to cross-site scripting attacks. We automatically tag all of the data that's coming into your application via the type system. So if you try to print out a piece of text, it will automatically HTML escape all of the entities. And then if you pull in some special HTML, it won't double escape it. All of this is handled by the type system. It's a much more complicated thing to manage in either a dynamically typed system or a language like Java, which makes it much more difficult to leverage the type system to do things like that. So if what you're concerned about is producing robust quality software, I would say you should still be considering Haskell.
How about the velocity of development? You've obviously used other web frameworks. Does this seem faster to you to get from concept to seeing the web page pop up? Or is it the same speed? Fewer programmers, more programmers required to get it to the same place?
So I usually like to say that I'm the worst person in the world to answer a question like that. For me, Yasoda is the most intuitive thing ever written. I can do anything I ever want to do very quickly. So I can't. I don't feel like I'm qualified to answer that question appropriately. I can't say that a lot of people. What I've heard is there are a lot of people out there who have been using Ruby on Rails for a while and are coming into Haskell. And yeah, they say that overall to get the initial thing up and running with Ruby on Rails is a little bit faster than using Yasode. But long term, the maintenance pays for itself. That there's simply, because of the way that we use the type system, because the compiler is doing so much more work for you, there's just less work for you to do long term. So if all you care about is getting that initial demo out, maybe you're better off with Ruby. But if what you care about is creating a piece of software that's going to last for the next 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, then I think that you know, putting in the a little bit of extra effort at the beginning is definitely going to pay off.
And what about when things blow up? I mean, what kind of debugger access do you have? How can you tell what's going on session-wise and things like that?
We have built in, so the logging tools are there. One of the things that we that has been discussed as a weakness of Haskell is we don't have the same level of stack traces that are available in a lot of other languages. That's actually something that's being worked on right now. It's going to be improved, hopefully. So when you get it, when you get a runtime error, it can be a little bit more difficult to debug it. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of the things that would show up as runtime errors in other languages show up as compile time errors in Haskell. Some people still don't like the way that the Haskell error messages show up from the compiler, but it's still easier to debug those than debugging a more obscure runtime error.
What was the process like to get O'Reilly to help you or let you write a book about this?
O'Reilly was actually, they were a great set of people to work with. I emailed them one day. I'd actually already written a fair amount of the book as online documentation. So that was already available. It was already open source online. I think I use Creative Commons, if I'm not mistaken. So I actually, I emailed them, sent them a link to the book, said, are you guys interested in working with me on this? They wrote back very quickly. They said they'd be very interested. And one of the things that I wanted as a prerequisite was that the book could stay available online, open source, for people to access it. They were incredibly supportive about it. It was a great experience working with them.
Cool. Yeah. Well, also being a published author from O'Reilly, I wholeheartedly agree. They're always been a great publisher for me. So it's definitely fun to work with. I just wanted to make sure that people knew that you were also an author from O'Reilly. That's very cool. Is this a project just a labor of love for you at this point, or do you imagine sometime turning this into some sort of commercial operation?
Well, the company that I'm working for now is FP Complete. And we're actually creating commercial tools for Haskell. And it's no secret anymore. Yasoda is going to be one of the bases for what we're building our tools off of. So from that perspective, that's my living now. That's what I'm doing full time. So even if they're funding my development that I still spend on Yasoda, and beyond that, I'm using Yasoda as the main tool in my on a day-to-day basis. So it was a labor of love. I was even when I started off working on Yasoda, I was using it for actual client projects. I've been very happy to see that my usage of Yasoda has been able to grow over time to the point where I'm basically working on it on a full-time basis.
So I'm interested to dig into that commercial activity a little bit more, if I may, Michael.
Sure.
If I wanted to start using Haskell for my website, are there any commercial hosting providers that I could go to who are going to give me support, or am I really just doing this in a shell account on my own?
For the moment, you're basically on your own. We have a lot of guides set up. A lot of people have experience with using either the Amazon Cloud, Heroku, a few other options available for managing the deployment. We have guides. But as far as just, hey, you know, this is another place where, for the moment, a system, you know, Java is much, or PHP, much more advanced. You can just go ahead and take your project, and there are probably a million hosts out there that you could just upload it to. We're lagging there right now, but I'm very hopeful that in the not-too-distant future, we're going to be catching up. There are definitely commercial efforts that are in the works to provide a much better solution.
Right, right. And I see that you've got, I read your install guide just now. You've got instructions on how to use apt-get to get it on a Debian-based system. So presumably you're going to work pretty well in an OpenStack environment in the future.
Yeah, actually, Yasod is included in Debian at this point. I've actually been working with the Haskell Debian maintainers. We're hoping to improve the process a little bit. We're working on a new initiative called Stackage to try to actually get packages coming out more often. We're definitely moving forward. I think it's going to work with something like OpenStack or other tools in the future.
Right, right. And is it included in the repositories on the other main Linuxes, Red Hat, on RHEL, and on OpenSUSE?
I'm not sure about OpenSUSE, but it's available in Fedora. It's available in Arch Linux, I think Gentoo and Nix as well. So there are a number of distributions that have built-in support.
I heard a little bit earlier you mentioned something about client side, that your focus is mostly on client side. Can you tell us more about that? I don't think I've seen anything on that yet.
Right. So this is definitely in the proof of concept stage. As a lot of people know, that the web world has been shifting more and more over the past few years towards doing a lot more work on the client side, which historically in the web world means, you know, more than 3 years ago. So historically, that meant writing a whole bunch of JavaScript. And as you know, since we're a whole bunch of Haskell programmers, we don't really like writing JavaScript. We like Haskell. So there have been a number of efforts to move forward to actually create some kind of Haskell that could run on the client side. The most commonly used Haskell compiler is GHC. There's an effort underway to create a JavaScript backend for GHC, and it's actually come along pretty well. It does some pretty amazing things. You're able to go ahead, it actually has green threads. It can do a lot of things on the client side. There are also more lightweight approaches. So Fay is the technology that I'm using right now. It's a pretty lightweight compiler that can go ahead and take a subset of Haskell and compile it into JavaScript. One of the very nice things about using a system like this is we're able to share data types between the server and the client. So in a system like that, you're able to go ahead and specify a set of commands, for example, that are going to be shared between the client and the server. You know, I'm going to create a blog. If I'm going to add a post, I need to put in title and description. And let's say that then 2 weeks later, you go out and you add a new field to this data type, and you only add it on the server side. As soon as you hit compile, the client side is going to let you know, sorry, you got to update this. So instead of finding out at runtime on the, you know, when it's actually sitting in the browser that you've got a problem, you find this out much sooner.
And you're saying Fay. How do you spell that?
Fay.
Oh, just like it sounds. I thought it might be some odd spelling there. Okay.
No. This one wasn't created by me, so it's got some normal spelling.
That's great. I'm familiar with the efforts of, say, Objective-J, which is sort of taking Objective-C and turning it into a JavaScript compiled language. And I know there's also an effort to make sure that Perl 6 can actually run as a JavaScript target. So I'm familiar with this technology. So how far along is that? Is it workable yet? Or is it someplace where I can see it? Is there another website for that I didn't find yet?
I think it's feilang.org, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. I don't remember if there's a hyphen in it or not. And then on GitHub, they have the Feilang organization. So you can definitely check it out. It's definitely workable. They have, on their site, they have a little IDE that you can play around with. If I remember correctly, they did some funny things where they combined that with the GHC.js that I'd mentioned earlier, and they actually compiled Fay into JavaScript so you could compile Haskell inside your browser into JavaScript, which starts to get a little confusing, but actually seems to work to some extent. So there are definitely a lot of issues still to be worked out. It's not a perfect solution, but it's definitely headed in the right direction. And it's one of the times when the whole Haskell community seems to be moving in the same direction. So I've seen efforts from the other two main Haskell web frameworks, HapStack and Snap. Both of them seem to be embracing Fay. People are creating bridges to use those, use the server and client side together. So it's definitely an exciting time.
Is this the sort of thing that I could slowly migrate more and more of my application over into the browser, or when I'm moving it into the browser, I really have to rewrite it because now it's got to be thinking about it in terms of AJAX calls and things like that.
I've actually never tried the approach of moving it piecemeal. To some extent, we've done that on the site that I'm working on right now. Some of the technologies that we worked on, we started off with a purely server-side approach, and then one of the new developers came in and said, hey, let's do this as a client-side app, and took some of the work and started migrating it bit by bit onto the client. To some extent, it really does need to be written over from scratch. On the other hand, all of the database code stays the same. The database code obviously is going to live on the server. We've just now created a wrapper that's serving JSON values instead of serving HTML. So a lot of the server-side stuff can stay mostly the same, but there's a fair amount of rewrite involved.
And you could probably pick a lot of the view code, the stuff that's going to turn those data objects into HTML, and just drop that on client-side, right?
You can, but on the flip side, a lot of the time you really do want to totally rewrite these things. We actually haven't yet gotten to the point where we're using the same templating languages on the client as we're using on the server. That's something we're considering doing. So my answer to that might change in the next month. But right now, you can't necessarily use the same view code on the server and the client.
And I think we're getting close to the end of the time here. So I just wanted to make sure, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
I think we've covered the main points. The main thing that if you're talking about the main issue that USOTA is addressing, it's using type safety to make web development a safer environment. And I think it's definitely doing a good job at that.
Okay, great, cool. Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. And I got to ask my two required questions. I don't know if you've heard any previous instances of this show, but I have to ask these. What's your favorite scripting language?
Favorite scripting language? Ouch. I guess I would have to say Perl, just because that's the one that I have the most experience with.
Yay!
Actually, that's actually the way that I got into Haskell in the first place, because like you mentioned, Perl 6.
In
Perl. Yeah, I saw this whole thing. What's this Haskell thing? But they're writing Perl 6 in it. Wait, that's got to be kind of cool. That was the first time that I ever heard about Haskell.
And mine too. And so, I've still got the scars up here from beating my head into that wall over there trying to learn this thing. So you've inspired me. So hopefully I'll go back and when I get my copious spare time, maybe next week when I'm actually on my winter break, I'll have some time to actually try some stuff out. And your favorite text editor?
That's an easy one, Vim. I'm sure I'm going to get killed for that one. Yeah.
That's okay.
Next guy?
Yeah. Because my editor can emulate your editor. That's the important thing. All right. All right, good. Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, and thanks for coming on the show and talking about USOTA. Hopefully I pronounced it closer this time, and hopefully it'll stir up some interest in it for you.
Okay, thank you very much. It was great talking to you, too.
Very good. So that was Michael Snoyman, who was talking to us about his web framework written in Haskell. What do you think there, Simon?
Oh, it's obviously hellish cool. I've got my doubts about how many web developers would actually go and use it because the learning curve on the language, it's I've got my little section up on my bookcase up there of languages that I don't think I'll ever be able to learn. Scalar is up there and Haskell's right next to it. And I have a hunch that the learning curve is going to be a bit steep for any general purpose web developer. But I can see that somebody who was, developing a system in Haskell and needed some web features for some purpose would find it really useful and that it would be a very popular tool for them. What do you think? You've got a good background in web hacking. What's your view?
Well, I said this already a couple times, but I'll say it again. You know, it's, for some reason, my brain just wasn't getting all the way around Haskell, and I don't consider myself to be any dummy. You know, like I said, I think I listed something like 70 programming languages on my resume at one point, and then I just stopped counting them anymore. So it isn't that I can't learn languages. It's just something was just weird about Haskell as I was trying to learn it back when we were doing that Perl 6 effort with that. But, you know, what Michael said inspired me. So I think I'm going to go take and actually I saw a couple new tutorials and I started actually reading through it this morning and I went, huh, this is not as difficult as I remembered. There's also a lot of great stuff from Haskell that's being borrowed back into Perl 6. This whole infinite list thing, lazy list thing is actually ending up in Perl 6. So as I'm studying Perl 6, it's starting to make sense again because I go, oh, I know that feature now from what I've studied in Perl 6, so I can take that back to what I know about Haskell. So we'll see if that works as well. And since we do have a couple more minutes here before I have to start wrapping up the show, so I am going to say that people who bet entirely on using type safety as their main means of figuring out, you know, if it compiles, it must be good kind of stuff. It always scares me a little bit because I actually have written a couple of articles on why type safety is neither sufficient nor necessary, because it's insufficient to capture things that are correlated but live in two different variables. So my classic example of that is if you have a variable representing the month of the year and a variable that represents the day of the month, there's some inherent correlation between the two, but a type doesn't capture that. You'd have a separate type for each of those variables. And this is contrived because, yes, you just use a date object and would have the type in that. But let's say you had – every system has these types of things where there are correlated variables. Every system does. It's the nature of programming. So you can't represent the cooperative state of two variables by a single type. And therefore, you cannot prove using type safety that we didn't pick January 31st. Excuse me, February 31st. What month doesn't have 31 days in it, Randall? There we go, February 31st. And so that means you have to write tests. You actually have to sit down and write tests that verify that your system works under all the proper inputs and outputs that would apply to those two tapes. Okay, then if you have to write tests anyway, then those variables could just have been two generic variables. They didn't have to be limited 1 to 31 and January through December because your tests will then prove if it's work. So that's the real short version of it. Basically, that proves that type safety is neither sufficient, and because it's not sufficient, is therefore not necessary.
I love that view, but as an old Pascal programmer, I have to say that I'm a big fan of type safety, and I much prefer a language that takes it seriously. So I don't see that as a defect. I think that actually having a type safe language like they're claiming is a great benefit. Now, you're entirely right that it doesn't mean that your algorithm's correct, but it can mean that you can not worry about all the problems that come from abusing the syntax and semantics of the language.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, I guess it's like when I hear people say, well, it compiled, therefore I'm done. And because we have such a good, strong, type-safe language, that's the claim I'm saying I can undermine with my argument.
Right.
It writes 80% of the tests for you automatically because if it does compile, then it passes all those tests where you know you haven't passed the wrong type variable into the wrong slot. But that's not the only problems we have as programmers. We also have algorithmic issues and these correlated issues that a type system cannot manage. So you have to have tests for those. So it writes most of the stuff for you, yes. It does solve most of the problems, but it's not sufficient, and therefore, if it's not sufficient, you could argue that it's not necessary, except that it does help as a sort of a belt and suspender sort of thing to do that. So, yeah, there's me on that. Anything else on today's guest?
No, I'm just fascinated by it. I would really like to see some real world examples of websites that are built using the framework. So I'll probably go digging and see what I can find.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, speaking of upcoming guests. That's the awkward transition for the day. We have no guest next week because the Brick House. The Brick House is taking the week off. There's going to be reruns all next week, which also means I get to kind of take the Christmas week off and just do what I want to. I'm actually flying back to Portland on Sunday, and I'm going to be up there for a couple weeks hanging out with family and friends, and then back down here to California to get my job started again on the first Monday of following, I think, Christmas week, New Year's week anyway. Immediately following that week, in fact, we have Node.js. They were scheduled a while back, and we had to move them later. That's a high-performance, multi-threaded JavaScript engine. Sounds really fun. It's kind of the basis of a lot of things. Actually, it's similar to what we just talked about today. It's basically, but instead of doing it in Haskell, you do it in JavaScript and have a high-performance engine based on that. GEvent, which is a fast Python event loop based on libevent. And actually, he mentioned libevent today, so it's related to that, but it's Python now. So we'll just cover all the different languages and all the high-performance things that we can write with all of them. Concrete C++, CMS is a CMS made for marketing but built for geeks. I love that catchphrase. I had to lift that from the website. Again, a CMS that's in heavy use around. Auphonic, which is an automatic audio post-production web service for broadcasters and podcasters. This is not open source software in the sense that you can download something. This is actually a service that's being provided for free, but it's entirely built using 15 or 20 different pieces of open source technology, some of which we've had on the show before. But I kind of wanted to bring on some sort of a group that actually had like an end user solution, showing how with open source they're really leveraging it and making some really cool stuff on there. We got Tapper, which is a test infrastructure originally developed at AMD and now is available for testing stuff, firing up a box from scratch and throwing an application on it and seeing if it works correctly. Media Goblin, which is a media publishing platform, sort of similar to Flickr or YouTube, but your own. Nice. Zotonic, it's an Erlang-based web framework. Speaking of esoteric languages, we'll just have everybody. Let's write it in. We're going to get one done in Focal, I'm pretty sure. Maybe a logo. Let's get one done in logo. That'd be kind of cool. All right. Take PHP. Oh, that's written in less esoteric language. That's a web framework written in PHP. Again, a lot of web frameworks because these seem to be the popular things these days. Poodle, which is a web-based translation framework. They were originally scheduled a while back. Uncake PHP also was, but we got them back in Q1. I'm really excited about the next one after that. We just added this to the schedule, the Dart language. It's gotten a lot of buzz at Google of being a high-performance language that runs in the browser but can be compiled directly to JavaScript, so it's backwards compatible. Chrome understands Dart directly, so you can write high-performance client-side apps, very rich apps, that sort of thing in it. And we're going to get one of the Google guys to come out and actually talk about it, which is really nice. We had Gilad Braca? On the show about 2 years ago, and he has a lot to do with Dart, but we're actually getting one of the other team members. I forget who it was. We're going to get one of their team members on that. And finally, rounding up the Q1 schedule. See, I've been busy. I've been sending my email out, so fill up Q1. We have Pinto. That's Jeffrey Thalhammer, I believe his name is. He came on the show a while back to talk about Perl Critic, which is something that made sure that your Perl code was good and well-written. He's actually now created the equivalent of a localized CPAN, which is makes it possible for you to compile your code up once for your entire installation and then install it from there rather than having to go to each machine and compile up the CPAN over and over again, which is seems like a big waste. But this should be a really great little thing there. So a lot of people coming up in Q1. If you go to the spreadsheet at twit.tv/floss, linked from there, you can see all these guests and more. If you have a project that we haven't talked about or you see a project on the list there but I'm not taking any action on it, write the project leader and tell them to email me, merlin@stonehenge.com, and I will put them on the top of the list waiting for scheduling. As I said, we're pretty much booked up on Q1, but I will open Q2 probably in another month or so we can get some more people booked in for that. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+ and at Floss Weekly on both Twitter and Identica. I try to post things there as I update the schedule or as things happen. We have a live chat room, as I mentioned earlier. We've got you can go to live.twit.tv while we're taping. We tape at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays when we're taping. Again, not next week, but every week after that. You can follow me personally, Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter and Identica, and I'm also Randall L. Schwartz on Google+. I try to post about 3 or 4 interesting links every day on there when I get a chance. And if you've been following all those places, you also know that I am, in fact, 35 pounds lighter than I was 16 weeks ago. I'm down to 180 as of yesterday, and that's on low-carb, high-fat, also known as a ketonic diet. Steve Gibson did a show on that called Climbing Sugar Hill, if you want some details from the Twit Network. But otherwise, just Google for ketonic diet or low-carb, high-fat, and it's been an effortless diet. I'm going to go another 10 pounds probably and see what my new body fat percentage is. And if it's within a healthy, acceptable level, I will probably stay at 170 because I'm tired of buying new pants. So that's it for me for now. Sorry, Simon. Where can we find you and what are you up to?
Sorry. I was actually wondering whether if I shaved my beard off, whether I'd lose as much weight as you, Randy. getting rid of the beard seems to work well for you. So I'm doing absolutely nothing. I'm still writing my column every week for InfoWorld. You'll find that every Friday on InfoWorld.com and also in Computer World UK if you are a UK reader. You can find almost everything that I do linked from webmink.com, webmink.com, and you'll find me as Webmink on Identica on Twitter. on Google Plus. I've got a fairly steady stream running. I'm very excited to have just started a Kiva group for open source. So if you are a Kiva lender, I would love you to join the open source group for Kiva and add your gifts and loans into the pool to show just how generous the open source community is generally. In January, I have absolutely no engagements at all. Going to do some heavy duty writing. But then at the start of February, there's FOSDEM. I'll be over there in Brussels, and I hope I'll see you there too. Now's the time to get in your proposals. The call for papers is ending on lots of the dev rooms in FOSDEM around about now. So get your papers in there. If you'd like me to speak at your open source user group, or if you'd like me to come and visit your company, now's the time to make an inquiry for the spring. I've got travel around Europe and in the US coming up in the spring, so I would love to see you. I think that's just about it. Take a look at webmic.com if you want to find out what I'm up to. Back to you, Randall.
Thank you. And yes, I am a Kiva lender, so I will have to join your group and help you fund things. It's really a great way to do these, it's mostly microloans with fairly short turnarounds. So you can loan your money out, and when the money gets paid back, you can say, nope, I want to go fund this project for a while. And even if it doesn't get paid back, it's like, hey, you still contributed to a great project. So it's all really cool that way. So very good. And Simon, I want to thank you for helping me round out the 2012 year by helping me do the last show of the year. Thanks for getting up. Well, you don't get up early for your show. It's like evening for you.
It's been dark for 2 hours here, actually, Randall.
Okay. Well, for me, it's getting up early in the morning because I'm on the West Coast. I'm on Leo time. So that's how I roll. And so great. So that's the last show of the year. We'll see you again in 2013. We've got a whole new lineup, as we said. Lots of new shows coming up. And we'll see you again next time on Floss Weekly.